Welcome to Teachers Teaching Teachers. It is January 27th, 2010, and we have a show tonight. We have a couple of guests who are going to talk to us about fair use and digital media learning in general, and we'll just kind of see where it goes, I think. We have Renee Hobbs with us from Media Education Lab at Temple University, and Troy Hicks, who is at Michigan. Where are you, Troy?
I'm at Central Michigan University.
Yeah. And both of them have done some writing and thinking and talking about fair use and best practices around media literacy education. And Chris Sloan thought it would be a great idea, and we are very happy that he has kind of planned and produced the show and is going to lead the conversation. Chris from Salt Lake City, Utah. Welcome. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Paul, I was really relating to what Chris was saying. If I'm having this problem, other people must be having the problem. That's certainly in the spirit of the way we try to have these conversations, and I know I certainly have those issues too.
Say a little more. What's the problem? Because we have his notes about that.
Well, the problem being, you know, how do you know when you're doing something right and when you're doing it wrong? And I think, you know, even with the best intentions, it's a little bit still crazy.
Yeah,
what can
and,
you use? What can't you use?
And what I was thinking was, you know, I've been teaching 25 years, and I have been on and off, you know, like I've taught the First Amendment for through that time, and actually used a guide way back in the late 80s from someone from Temple. It's called Understanding the First Amendment, and it was a guy named Thomas Evesledge. I don't know how to say his name.
Yeah, Evesledge.
Okay, Evesledge. Okay. And so I was using his thing, and so I guess my concept of copyright goes way back and really didn't change too much in all those years. I guess I always thought of that C just meant, you know, can't do it or something like that. And so, you know, the more I started to read, you know, look over Renee's website and then Troy's book, Digital Writing Workshop, came out, I started to realize I didn't really know a whole lot. So, you know, I read more about it, and then I felt like I still had a lot of questions. So then I thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could get Renee and Troy together and to give them some examples and maybe talk us through the process. How do you work through the fair use issues? So if it's okay, I thought, Renee, you might start things off and just talk about your work and what the Media Lab does in a nutshell at Temple. And then maybe how you started creating the code with Peter Yazzie, I think, and mm-hmm. Patricia Offerheide?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Right after it came out, we did have Peter on the show, too. So.
Oh, and that was another reason, you know, because I did listen to that show with great interest and, you know, listen to it again. But what kept coming back to me was, you know, we threw these hypotheticals at Peter. And he kept saying, well, if I had the example in front of me, I think I might be able to talk about it a little more. So I thought, well, let's do something where we talk a little more about it and actually have some examples. So hopefully we'll drop those examples in the chat room, the links to them.
Yeah, that's right. So the Media Education Lab is a research center at Temple University. Our mission is to improve the practice of media literacy education through scholarship and community service. We do teacher education, we do curriculum development, and we do research, and we define media literacy as an expanded conceptualization of literacy that includes critical analysis and media composition. I've been
Renee, sorry, I gotta jump in here. The community service was a provocative thing you just said. That who does the community service? Are you guys that for students? Or
great question. Yeah, both undergraduates and our graduate students participate in supporting media literacy in the field. So our undergraduates work in youth media programs throughout North Philadelphia and across the city. And our students also work in kind of elbow to elbow with middle school and elementary school and high school teachers who are interested in exploring how to implement media literacy or how to implement some technology integration project. So that is kind of a form of service learning. We also host the Media Smart Seminars, which are free, open to the public events that bring in people to talk about topics that the public is interested in. Last fall, we had a guy from the independent film channel, IFC, and he led us through a media literacy program on how to critically analyze on-air promotions. I'm sure you're familiar with those. You see about 20% of them when you watch television. There are 20% of all the commercials on television. They're television commercials for television shows. You know those? Coming up next, Tuesday at 11. Stay tuned. We basically looked at the generic form of the on-air promotion and really deconstructed them as, you know, as persuasive forms, led by a guy who has been editing that type of television text for 20 years. So those are the kind of programs that bring together people in the community and K-12 educators and graduate students and even teenagers. So that's the kind of community service we're talking about.
Anyway, then it was November of 2008, it seemed like, if I have my dates right, that you came out with the Code of Practices in Fair Use for Media Literacy Education. And yes. I was wondering about how, you know, you worked with two other people, how you got together, why you felt that was necessary, how that collaboration went.
Yeah, the collaboration began about 3 years earlier when Pat Oefterheide had just finished developing the Code of Best Practices for Documentary Filmmakers. Basically, she discovered that documentary filmmakers were also shortchanging their themselves in creative ways and in financial ways by not understanding the doctrine of fair use and how it applied to their work. So at some conference or another, we've known each other for 30 years, and she was describing this project, and at some point we sort of realized that, you know, media literacy educators also rely so heavily on the use of copyrighted materials in our own work. And we ourselves have tons of confusion about how the doctrine of fair use applies. So that's how the project got started. And we were really grateful to have the support of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, who I think really supported the project in a way because as they were getting started on their digital learning initiative, realizing that in some way, media literacy educators were already, you know, mired in some of the paradoxes and tensions and contradictions because of their, you know, reliance on the use of mass media and popular culture texts in the classroom. So that's how we got started, and we basically had three phases to our work. We first interviewed about 60 teachers in one-hour interviews where we tried to get a deep, deep understanding of how they conceptualized copyright and fair use and how they understood their work in relation to, you know, essentially how they defined what good teaching practices were. Then we held a series. From there, we developed a set of like hypothetical scenarios that really were the bugaboos for that people kept coming back to over and over. Can I do this? Can I do that? And we shared those hypothetical scenarios in 10 different cities where we gathered together about 15 educators from three broad groups, college and university faculty in the fields of education, media studies, mostly in those two fields, sometimes in library science, K-12 teachers across the board in English, social studies, health, library media specialists, technology leaders, and then folks who work in after-school programs, youth settlement houses, nonprofit organizations who are doing media literacy outside of a school setting. And we brought them together in 4-hour focus group, basically asked them to reason through their understanding of how fair use applies to these various scenarios. We were very fortunate in all 10 of those cities to have Peter Yazidi, one of the world's leading experts on copyright law, to help us understand what the law actually says and what its purpose is. And after a year of doing that, it was obvious what the consensus was. And so we used the consensus we found in the focus group meetings to create the Code of Best Practices in Fair Use for Media Literacy Education.
Chris, can I jump right in here with a question?
Oh, you go right ahead.
I was wondering how you find talking to teachers about this. And I'll give you a little scenario. A strange thing happened to me. I overheard some students talking in the technology lab, and they were talking about a test where there had been a trick question, an extra credit question, and it turned out it had been taken from one of those websites that are used for teaching that's not really true. And when the students had Googled the trick question for extra credit, they had gone right to the website where they found exactly the same words, and they wanted to know, is this just plagiarism, or is this fair to do this? And I still haven't had the nerve to go talk to the teacher, but I really would like to because I don't think the teacher knows at all. So I was wondering how you find ways to talk to teachers about this. I mean, we're all struggling with it. So, you know, we're already struggling, but what about the teacher who's not even struggling?
Well, I think, you know, we all share, don't we? The culture of teaching is a culture that's built on sharing. When you find something good, you share it, right? You use it and you share it. So I think where we start with teachers who, for whom this isn't even on their radar screen, is to acknowledge how much sharing is part of the ethic at the heart of what we do as educators, and to acknowledge that sharing is not a bad thing. Sharing is not stealing. And right now we've got a cultural behemoth that's, you know, the media industry sort of really trying to hammer us down around, you know, sharing is stealing. And I think that has created a lot of fear where there didn't used to be fear at all.
And one of the things I noticed in the code and also in Troy's book is the idea of questioning and thinking it through rather than looking for or getting an answer, you know, yes or no, is this violation or not? And so the code was really, the premise seems to be, you know, thinking through whether this thing is transformative, whether it, you know, is fair use. And Troy, I noticed that in your book, you keep coming back to that. And almost like if I could imagine your writing process, when you first did the first draft of your book, your notions of copyright kind of changed. You mentioned in the book as you started to research fair use. So maybe Troy, you could talk about fair use pops up a lot in your book. You know, why is that so important as you see it?
Sure. Well, you know, first I want to respond really quickly to another reason why this is all so sticky. And part of that, I think, is that, you know, as teachers, we've always been told those things about 30 seconds of this or 10% of that, and whether you close the door and hide or whatever. That was one of the main themes that picked up on Renee's session back at NCTE. Like, you know, there's the people that just close the door and do whatever, and then there's those of us that are wrestling with it. But I think there's like multiple layers of this. Like, one is like, how and why and when are we using this, and are we using it in a transformative way? Or are we just copying things for classroom use or redistributing them for classroom use? And then there's all this other stuff like the copying of illegal file sharing and things like that. So when someone says copyright, those are at least three ways that I think about it as an educator. And, you know, whether we're manipulating the media, just reproducing the media, or somehow stealing, or whatever phrase you want to call it, stealing the media. So I think that's what makes it so complicated. And Chris, you're absolutely right. When I was writing the book, actually, it was a year ago, I did get to go to EduCon and met Renee. and another one of her colleagues doing a session there, and Paul and Christina and I, we sat there and our heads just started spinning about this whole copyright thing, because you know, as you guys too have struggled with this over years, you know, trying to get kids to use Creative Commons and things that are in the public domain, and you know, attributing their sources and all that. We have these kind of academic standards, and we want to make sure they're, you know, adhering to copyright law. So as we're trying to muddle through the teaching of how to create digital writing and digital media, we're trying to understand all this stuff. And yeah, so my thoughts were changing in the process of writing the book, and all three of you, you know, in some way, shape, or form have influenced my thinking on that. And so I thank you for letting me be here tonight. I'm just trying to absorb some more and hopefully add some commentary to some of the examples you're going to share.
And at some point, one last thing, if we could be clear about, you know, as we're talking about things, the concept of transformativeness and repurposing and what it means to add value, that would be helpful for me, so we can kind of try to define those as we go.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we already have a question from the chat room of exactly that. And also, Gail in the chat room noticed that she just had an email from a teacher asking for royalty-free, copyright-free images of Haiti.
Royalty-free, copyright-free.
Oh.
Copyright-free.
But see, that's really sad, isn't it? Right?
Well, why? Renee, say why it's sad.
I guess one of the things that I think maybe as our understanding of the law has deepened, and I think, you know, Troy describes the process by which he got into it. You know, in my book, I describe how it happened to me. What happened to many of us educators is copyright was never on the agenda. Then all of a sudden, there was all this fear and anxiety about 30 seconds or 10% or what you couldn't do, and there was this great sense of that we might be violating. And then all of a sudden came like a savior, you know, to rescue us, Creative Commons. And we went, oh, there's the answer to our problem, right? And actually, I think it's important for your listeners to understand that the Creative Commons is a licensing scheme. And that basically is a way that owners can formally grant permission for others to use their work. And a licensing scheme is another way of asking permission. It's another kind of author right. And while it's wonderful that the Creative Commons licenses give us users a lot more flexibility in how we use materials, that doesn't take away or diminish or in any way abrogate our user rights. Because remember that the purpose of copyright is to promote creativity and the spread of knowledge. And the protection of author rights is only one half of the bargain that is at the heart of copyright law. The other half of the bargain is fair use. Fair use is what makes libraries legal. If we didn't have fair use, libraries would be against the law. So,
and I guess I used to think that, you know, that you use Creative Commons so that then you don't have to worry about copyright. And one of the things that kind of changed my thinking as I read through your guide was the idea that the Supreme Court has pointed out that fair use keeps copyright from violating the First Amendment. And so I think we're all about, like on Youth Voices and other places like it, we're all about having kids learn to be citizens and have access to information and educate so that we're all functioning members of a democracy. So I think that part, I guess, it was just an eye-opener for me.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that what happened was because most of us learned about Creative Commons first, before we learned about fair use, we sometimes see it as replacing or somehow some kind of, like you said, safer approach. When in fact, fair use is the law, and educators can claim fair use simply by engaging in a process of critical reasoning where we ask ourselves, what is the purpose and context of my use? How is that similar or different to the author's original intent? How does my use of the work benefit society? How does it harm the copyright holder? And when we work through that analysis, for most educators in a lot of different contexts, we discover that for both students and for teachers, we have broad rights to use copyrighted material. For instance, we have the right to use news photographs of Haiti to promote learning about news and current events and learning about the social and political context that is so rapidly changing in that country as a result of the earthquake.
And Paul, your students, I notice, have been writing a lot about Haiti and also including images that, even if they come from Flickr, you know, they're copyright on some of those. And so to me, that seems like fair use, because how could that's part of how to tell the story is to visually show the damage. And so how have you talked about that, Paul, in your class?
Well, working with Creative Commons still seems like an important element of media education, but I am kind of not as convinced this year as I was last year about that. So that's a bit of a change. I'm not answering you directly. I'll get to that. I do want to add one more category, and that's a category that we explored in the New York City Writing Project. A librarian there, Michael Dodes, this summer kind of pointed us to look at inline linking as yet another place that might protect us in some way about copyright issues. So that most of the images that are published on Youth Voices are in fact not owned on our server. So that it's not even clear we need to deal with fair use with those images. So I just wanted to bring that up as a possible, I don't know if that it gets too legal in that way, but.
Can I just add a quick? From a writing perspective, and what a writing mm-hmm. teacher needs to know and be able to do, I think that's a really fascinating question, because in some ways it kind of, you know, maybe not, but I guess I always think about that urban legend that you know, Disney would come and sue you if you used an image of Mickey Mouse, and it's like, well, if I'm pulling it off your server, am I really using it? If it just happens to appear in my web page, I haven't downloaded it and put it on my server. I'm just pulling in and using it. So, and I know that all this stuff about fair use complicates and makes it even more interesting, but it's one of those digital literacy moments that I think we need to think about when we ask kids how they compose digital texts. And that's very important, is, you know, where does that digital copy actually exist, and how are you giving attribution and so forth? So I think that's
And it's absolutely complicated, because the very act of using the internet involves making a copy. So, you know, you can't use the internet without making a copy. Copying is at the heart of what the internet does to display pages. So what's going to happen over the next 20 years, because law follows social practice, is the law will redefine what copying means in relation to digital technologies. And if we have a long view, we understand we're in a place of great transition right now. But I go back to Troy's point about, if we're trying to teach kids about composition and at the idea of respecting ownership and authorship, which really is a fundamentally vital part of mm-hmm. what one's ethical responsibilities are in the digital age, then I think it's really important to explore the idea of how we respect authors and how we respect users, and how it is that the law balances the rights of authors and users, and how we use critical thinking to determine where the bounds of that balance lie.
So, and just to follow up on that really quickly, I think it's that critical thinking moment that, you know, typically when we taught writing instruction, you know, it was always about, you know, cite your sources and gather appropriate evidence and details. And now we have these other layers of complication about, okay, when and how do you cite your sources, and when is it okay to bring in, you know, something off of someone else's server or something, and how do you, you know, do you make a hyperlink to this and those types of things. So just add that as a quick footnote.
And Troy, you know why that's so fascinating? Because it turns out, you know, that from a legal point of view, citing your sources doesn't have anything to do with the law, right?
Oh, right.
And
right.
So it is whether we cite sources or how we cite sources is a matter of a professional obligation within a discourse community, and there are different norms within different discourse communities about attribution or citing one's sources. But that doesn't have, citing sources doesn't have anything to do with copyright, because citing sources is an ethical obligation, whereas copyright is a legal obligation.
Right, and so, that actually was one of the points that you made in the session at NCTE that, again, you know, really shifted my thinking some more. And how to explain that to college students that I teach, let alone to high school and middle school students, like, to me, it's just like, that it just blows my mind to try, you know. Yeah, on the one hand, you have to cite your sources. On the other hand, it doesn't matter where you get them from, because, you know, fair use says that you can use them for educational purposes. I know it's not quite like that, but just this notion that for so long we've thought about the ways that kids should be so accurate in citing their sources and, you know, things like this, and now we have we always have, but because of the document that you all produced, the Code of Best Practices, and the work that you're doing right now, it just really helps me think about the fact that there are just different ways to go about this, and you have to kind of be working on these parallel tracks with kids, thinking that, as you just said a moment ago, you're working with an academic discourse community, and this is the way that you have to provide evidence and prove your points and so on when you make an argument. But then you're working in this digital realm that involves, you know, copyright and legal issues and things like that. And the rules aren't quite the same. They're kind of close, but not always. And one doesn't necessarily follow the other. So it's,
yeah, I think of it this way. I think it's really useful to use a genre lens to think about when and how attribution is appropriate. When you're writing an academic paper and you're teaching kids about academic or scholarly discourse, the norms for attribution are well defined, even down to where the periods and the italicized stuff goes. But if you're working to create some other genres, there are different norms for attribution. For instance, you'll never see a comma, author, comma, date, comma, in the New York Times. New York Times doesn't use author, date, attribution system. They use an attribution system where it's built into the text, according to expert from blah, 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 comma, quote. That's an attribution system that's normative to journalism. In public service announcements, you know, those 30-second persuasive TV commercials or other kind of video messages, you'd be crazy to end that 30-second powerful, emotional, tug-your-heartstrings, call-to-action thing with a long list of, you know, sources cited. That would totally ruin the whole point of the PSA. Kids understand that there are different norms for attribution, different types of texts, and in fact, poets and memoirists and novelists refer to other people's ideas and works without using any form of attribution at all. And in some generic forms, that's expected and understood. So I think what happened is as we get nervous and fearful, we get more rigid, and that's a problem, because our students can appreciate the complexity of when attribution is important and valued and when it's not appropriate, and I think we got to give them credit for that. But when it comes down to the legal issues, that idea of thinking about transformativeness is really about asking questions that we English teachers are really good at asking. What's your purpose? Why did you use the other person's material? How did your use of the material change the impact of the communicative function? And did you use just as much as you needed? Or are you repeating or rebroadcasting or retransmitting and in some way competing with the person who created the original materials? Those are questions that are basically at the heart of the way we English teachers think about helping students understand their purpose, their audience, and their goals. And so I think it's actually pretty easy. I think once teachers have a deep understanding of copyright and fair use, I think it's pretty easy for them to integrate that into their teaching.
Right. And, you know, Paul just asked this question in the chat room. I think he's being slightly sarcastic.
Wow.
Here, but I just want to make one other quick comment here. You know, Renee, you just made this moment about, you know, you make this 30-second PSA and then you ruin the moment by having the credits at the end with all the sources that you cite. This is another element of multimedia composition. So if students are producing a research project and this 30-second spot is one piece of it, maybe the expectation is that the attribution for all those sources comes on the corresponding wiki page where that video is embedded as a YouTube. So then we're thinking about legally you can use this and do this in this way and present this 30-second video. You don't need to worry about citing your sources there. But in the academic community, and to make sure that you're following the norms and conventions of what we would expect, you know, a good proficient English writer to do, on your webpage as a supplement to that video, you have your list, and then maybe at the end of the video, all they have is just a link to the URL. So, you know, the viewer has to go, I need to go check out that URL. But that in and of itself changes the writing process, because we're so accustomed to saying, put your sources right at the end or put them as footnotes. Well, you don't footnote a 30-second PSA, you know, and I think that's the point you're making, but it's an interesting complication. So, sorry, Paul, I cut you off there.
Here's an interesting one. Maureen in the chat room said, I had sixth graders who wanted to use the life photos on Google Images for a project. I said no, since it wasn't transformative use. Still tend to go for safe versus sorry. What do you think of that one?
What kind of photos?
Say it again.
She said, I had sixth graders who wanted to use the Life magazine photos on Google Images for a project.
I wonder what they wanted to do with those images.
I wonder. Let's ask her. She said she didn't think it was transformative. Let's see if we can find her.
Well, while we're on the topic of transformative use, I put an example in the chat room. And Renee, I think this is how we first started emailing a while ago. I think this example might be in your book. It's the Bose slideshow where he's comparing two photographers.
Yep.
And he is using copyrighted images. These are clearly things that are not meant to be reproduced in a similar fashion or whatever, but, you know, he's using them. So, you know, maybe as we think through the questions, if you have that in front of you, how would I apply the guide to something like this?
Okay, that's a great question. So one thing worth thinking about is that before we talk about transformativeness, again, we don't want to get too rigid about this. The broad question or the broad balance that the doctrine of fair use is designed to protect is helping the interests of society, balancing the broad social benefits of sharing copyrighted work against the private interests of the copyright holder. So the broad doctrine of fair use tells us that we can claim fair use when the social benefit of the use of the copyrighted material exceeds the harm to the private cost to the copyright holder. That's the balancing act. So we ask social benefit versus harm to copyright holder. So I don't want to get too literal about transformativeness, because there are other kinds of uses that are protected that are not transformative. So for instance, illustrative uses of copyrighted material are in many, many cases likely to be protected under fair use, when we can make the argument that the broad social benefit of that illustrative use of the copyrighted material help society more than it harms the copyright holder. We could certainly make that argument in students' powerful writing and reflection about the human cost of the Haiti earthquake. Although student reproduction of journalists' copyrighted images may have some quote-unquote harm or cost to the copyright holder, we could see the very evident social benefit that results from students engaged in reflecting, empathizing, understanding the complex set of upheavals that that country has just undergone and the kind of development practices that must be completed for those people to survive and to thrive. So the underlining point I'm making is you have to have a big picture understanding of the purpose of copyright and not get hung up in the and not think of it as something that has to be turned into minutia, because it doesn't work that way.
But there's a question in the chat room, how big is society? So in this case, back to not the Haiti example, which we'll come back to, but photography example. So this was students teaching or presenting to each other, but not only in my class, to Susan's class in New York because they did the project, and to Sarah's class in Maine. We were all researching famous photographers and talking about their technique so that then we could teach each other, the students could teach each other how those photographers did achieve those effects. And then they went out and did what was called tribute photography, which they tried to do what that professional photographer did.
Right.
So we've got these slideshows that are on the site that use these copyrighted material. But to me, that benefits society. You define society as these three classrooms that are geographically far apart, right?
And so how does their use of copyrighted material benefit those 60 kids who are geographically dispersed?
To me, that it benefits them because they're in a photography class to begin with, and so they're studying these great photographers and therefore improving their own photography and learning about the history of photography at the same time.
Yeah, so isn't that wonderful? So that's a good example of a fair use reasoning. You've just done a fair use reasoning practice. And I think what's wonderful about the work that's happening on Youth Voices is that you guys are experimenting with and exploring how to use digital media together with really innovative pedagogy to help students develop. And it turns out that the law has great respect for the choices educators make in how they use copyrighted material in the classroom. And that's one of the reasons why we don't have any case history on an educator being sued for the use of copyrighted material where they said, listen, I'm using it for this good, solid educational reason, and here's why. There's no case law on that because every copyright holder understands how specially protected educators are under the doctrine of fair use.
And you know, Chris, I think it's been so interesting. My students' last photo discussion, they were required to sort of compare and contrast a piece of their own work with a photograph from another student in the group, and many of those were your students. And mm-hmm. I know when they saw a photograph used in someone else's post, they were actually just quite pleased. So it's a whole way of thinking, too, which is interesting. You know, that it doesn't feel like trespassing, but you're actually pleased if somebody else is talking about your work in that context. And I think
that's
the whole guides, the whole way, Paul, that you've set up for people to really share ideas. If you buy into that whole concept of sharing ideas and passions, then it works to share your work, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you're echoing a point that's made very beautifully by a Yale law scholar named Yohai Benkler, who in a really interesting book called The Wealth of Networks says, look, at the heart of our information economy today is the idea that through freely sharing, we actually create economic and other kinds of value, right? And so this old industrial model that you had to lock up your content and charge people for it is actually under great, great, we have a whole new model. We have an open source model that is powerfully showing us that it isn't the only way that value is created in our culture, because your students are discovering that through sharing comes enormous amounts, through free sharing, enormous amounts of value comes to both sides in the equation. And so I think that's important for students. I think that they're discovering that as in the way that they're using digital media. And what we're, I think what we're trying to do is create a place where they can have conversations about that and start to reflect on that a little bit.
Although Andrew Carnegie certainly understood that a long time ago, didn't he? When he set up libraries.
Indeed.
So let me try. Troy suggested that my question was something different. I mean,
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I kind of feel like I've stood in front of, so here's another example of a teacher, right? I've stood in front of classes introducing Creative Commons and said, when you need to find an image, how do you find that image? And everybody says, yeah, I go to Google and I find the image. And I say to kids, that stuff is not yours, right? It's copyrighted, it's protected, you really can't use it, and so forth. I don't need to give the whole story. But then we kind of look into Creative Commons, and I heard what you said earlier about that difference. But I guess I want to get back, I want to see if it's true that, well, I'm not asking this clearly. Is it true that we're back as far as when we work through all the issues? Aren't those students right that they can just go to Google and find any image they want to? And because they're putting it up in an educational context, they're okay with that? I mean, why do they even have to go through the fair use reasoning? I really kind of feel that way. And, you know, I mean, because if we're using inline linking, and if the other place to think about is that we just have to wait till we get a takedown notice, a DMCA notice, until then we're okay, right?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it that free?
But no. Paul, I think what you said is so amazing, because in a way, if that's what your students are saying, that's what I see too, is that that's the students are reading and learning all the time. Reading and learning is actually just an inherent part of their lives now with the Internet. And so they're always reading and learning. So why is this any different than any other time they're reading and learning and using things, right?
Okay. I don't understand. I mean, what I'm asking is, isn't it sort of as open as they think it is? Can't they just use any image they want to in their blog post?
No, they can't.
Why not?
Because sometimes when I use somebody else's work, I am literally taking bread out of their mouth. That is, I'm simply retransmitting it. And when I take your great work, Paul, and I post it up on my site, and I'm simply retransmitting the work, then I'm actually I am abrogating your right as the copyright holder to control that work. So thank goodness the law protects that.
So if I put it on my site, but not if I just use inline linking to reblog it in some way. I mean, I have students who use Tumblr, and they're doing that all the time. They're encouraged on Tumblr to you see something cool, reblog it, and it goes up on their blog. You know, nobody ever says to take that down. I just from a legal point of view, it feels like we have a lot of freedom. From a pedagogical and an ethical point of view, I want to protect people's work. So So the kind of fair use thinking that you said, the example that Chris gave, and the fair use thinking he did, was that a legal kind of thinking, or was that a pedagogical, ethical thinking that we were doing there?
It was legal, pedagogical, and ethical, I think. I think that's what's so wonderful about a fair use analysis is that it actually taps into all three of those systems. And probably the reason why, you know, we're here, and I guess the reason why a way to counter your argument, you know, isn't there just a technology fix with inline linking or whatever? Mm-hmm. And the reason why I kind of think that's not a comfortable place for us as teachers and learners is that right now, whether we like it or not, our students are engaging in a lot of illegal activity online when it comes to piracy. They are downloading files that actually are that are available in the marketplace and that have market value. They're downloading stuff to avoid paying for them. And that's not fair to the author. And you and I and all of us and many of your listeners are authors. Mm-hmm. And the reality of it is I create for a lot of purposes and most primarily to share my knowledge and to build my own curiosity. But the fact that there is a market reward for authorship is a meaningful thing in our culture, highly meaningful. And I want students to respect the rights of authors. So I actually don't want to say, oh, honey, there's a technology fix. You can just do this, blah, 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 and don't worry about it. Because I really, really want my students to respect authorship. But I also want them to understand that their rights as authors are not, 100% completely, locked up. Thank goodness authors can't completely control their work. Thank goodness the law protects users. And I think the fact that the law does that is so brilliant and elegant and smart that I just want my students to understand it.
But then here we are living day to day with Google News, which essentially is reblogging stuff from everywhere every single day.
Right. But so, and my question about Google News and what Paul was just saying a moment ago about Tumblr or retweeting or basically anything, you know, someone posts mm-hmm. something to Facebook, is it giving attribution to the source where it came from? I mean, most of the time, I'm imagining it does. But and then it becomes kind of this claim of there's this, you know, there's the legal claim of, well, you know, it's this person claiming this as their own, so it's clearly not fair use. It's copyright infringement. But then there's the academic claim of plagiarism. And I think that that's what you're kind of getting at. And for me, when I think about trying to teach students and teach teachers how to teach digital writing, this becomes the very tricky question because, you know, everything out there, you know, has the potential to be used in a transformative way. And if I'm misspeaking, I hope Renee you'll step in on and let me know. But my understanding of the fair use provision is that pretty much anything that's out there, whatever kind of copyright system it's under, whether it's a regular copyright, big C copyright, as a Creative Commons video says it, or the Creative Commons or public domain, it's up for grabs for educational fair use. The question is to the degree to which it's transformed and then takes away, you know, is the benefit greater or whatnot? And I just think it's a fascinating question. And so reblogging and Google News and retweeting, you know, then you have to say, well, what's the purpose of that? Did you add value to it? So if you just retweet without adding anything to it, is that adding value? I don't know.
I do want to just make one little point. There's one thing about what you said that isn't quite right, at least
legally. Yeah, please so correct me because I want to understand it.
Yeah, the shorthand in the law is generally licenses trump fair use. So what that means is that if you sign a license, like with United Streaming, with a database management company or with somebody, if you sign a license, then you have signed away your fair use rights. So So a license is a contract, right? And so that trumps that. That actually, once you've chosen to engage in a contract relationship with a copyright holder, then you've given up your fair use rights.
So Renee, let me just, and this has been an issue that keeps coming up on our show through the fall, when we're working with DIGO, for example, and then also working with library databases. The very specific example that I'll give is that we now, through DIGO, can make a snapshot of something behind a library database. But I'm quite sure that that's breaking the license agreement. So is that an example of what you just said?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so putting then and putting that out, like making a link to that cached image that we have is not protected in any way by fair use, just because I'm using it for an educational purpose.
Yeah, so it's important for us to, as educators, realize that when a company comes calling with a wonderful, simple way for us to access blah, 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 then we want to actually think about, yes, there's an ease and convenience factor, but there's also a cost at the level of our rights, as our rights. So I think many educators are not, and library media specialists and technology people are not completely tuned into the cost benefit analysis that comes with tools that involve very often very detailed and very complicated licenses.
But if you could remind me of the author's name you mentioned earlier, Bernke?
Bankler, Yohai Bankler.
Yeah, right. And I have read some of that. That's exactly what the message that he's putting out there is exactly what we feel with these library databases. The value of the material in that is lessened because we can't share it with other people.
Right.
You know, it's like, and as wonderful as that stuff is, because we can't put our comments on it and show other people our comments and share it in a group,
yep,
it's less valuable.
Yep.
And when are those database people going to get that?
Well, they'll figure it out eventually. And I think actually what's exciting is to see that so many people are talking about this from so many different disciplines and fields that I think, we are seeing a big cultural shift in appreciating at a very profound level the social values of sharing, of free sharing. So I have confidence. We're all young still, right? We'll live to see the shift happening. It's happening all around us right now.
So, Chris, sorry if I'm dominating.
Go right ahead.
Okay, one of the questions, I wanted to kind of look at it from another perspective, and you've already brought it up, but from the perspective of the creator, we had a student publish a poem on Youth Voices, and I couldn't find it quickly here, but it doesn't matter too much. She put right at the top of it, "Do not copy this poem. It is not yours. You cannot have it. It is copyrighted. You know, you may not copy any part of it and republish it anywhere." So it's very interesting to me, right? It's really interesting to see a young person want to protect their work that way, right?
Right.
So I'm just, I mean, they really can't, can they?
Nope.
So, what do you say to that student?
Although, you know, she's actually taking a playbook off of Monsanto. Teachers, science teachers, often get these amazing videos from and DVDs from Monsanto about the wonders of bioengineering. And you watch this video, and it's all about how, like, you know, you can go in there at the DNA level, and you can mess around with the tomato and make it just perfect and blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the film, it says, this documentary may only be used for educational purposes to promote the wonders of genetic engineering. No critical commentary of this video is permitted. Now,
no
talk about a needless legal claim that is completely groundless and completely unconstitutional.
Right.
But, boy, that fancy legal language can scare us, can it?
So she's making a legal claim, but going back to the poet for a second, and what you're suggesting is that that could squelch people's ability to respond to her poem.
If they believe that she has the right to control her work that way. But she doesn't, because authors and users both have rights under the doctrine of fair use.
Well, that's the best way to make that balance clear, right? Which that meaning, if we get our kids creating things, then they will get the idea of what it means to want to have ownership of something.
Right? Yeah, that's
right. And to figure out that balance.
Yeah, that's right. Because in a way, I can kind of understand her feelings, right?
Sure, yeah.
She doesn't want somebody pulling out this little line and that little line and offering critical commentary. And can't we all relate to that in some other way? But we also can also see that if an author could 100% lock up their work the way she might think she wants to do, then really we couldn't actually have a knowledge economy. We couldn't actually teach and learn. We couldn't actually learn from each other. We couldn't actually create new things. So it really and truly would be a terrible world if authors had 100% control over their work. We really do need this balance that fair use offers us. And I don't think we need to be afraid of it, but I do think we need to reason it through with our kids. And I love the idea of thinking now students more than ever before can think through what it feels like from an author's point of view, because they are authors. And they can think through what it feels like from a user's point of view, because they are users. They're in a better position to understand the balancing act than any students at any point in human history, in a way.
And it is true what Susan said earlier about whenever my students' work is, published or, you know, used in one of Susan's students' blogs or whatever, they are really flattered, and that encourages them, inspires them to go do more work. But it's not really their job, so it's not like anyone's taking anything away from them and rebroadcasting their stuff in the same way. So they do have this sense of, as creators now, how it feels to have your stuff used, but it's like whenever it happens, they feel so good that maybe they think like everybody should feel like that.
Right.
Chris, were there any other examples we want to get to? We're getting low on time.
Do we have time?
Go for one more.
Okay.
If everyone's okay with it.
There was, I had an example of the student, and I'll drop it in the chat room, Craig, who had this post about MRAPs in Iraq. And so he writes this thing that's basically talking about a little dichotomy, or can't think of the word right now, but basically the MRAPs are designed to protect troops from mines, but they also at the same time isolate them because they're in, you know, these larger vehicles that are more removed from the population, which is actually not how you fight counterinsurgency, or not how you counter insurgency. So his thing is all about how these protect people, but are they a good idea because they may be perpetuating the violence that they're set out to protect soldiers from? And anyway, you know, he cites like a USA Today article. There's an image in there from a USA Today that is copyrighted. But to me, as we think through it, he's repurposed it. It's transformative, not that I'm using it too strictly there, but the purpose of his piece is more, you know, he has this question that he's trying to figure out, whereas the USA Today article that he's citing from and the other sources were actually more explanatory pieces. So I think sometimes when we talk about, you know, am I transforming this thing? To me, because the actual purpose of the writing is different, also
yep.
makes it different, right? He's
yep.
not just rebroadcasting the USA Today article.
No.
He's incorporating that and synthesizing that so that the purpose of the thing is actually different than the original.
Yeah. His purpose is to persuade, and the original piece was to inform. And what target audience is he reaching compared to USA Today?
It's Youth Voices, so it would be, you know, people his age who are reading the site.
And there's clues in his writing that he's writing for his peers, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, wow. There you
and
go.
And then, well, to kind of talk it through a little bit, and what I thought was interesting about it is, and then someone else in a response drops in a YouTube video that shows Marines ghostwriting the MRAP. So, you know, like where that came from, I'm not sure. You know, probably some guy just with his video camera who uploaded it to YouTube. But, you know, like, that was interesting, that kind of video response. And then in the end, one of the students says, the very last quote says, thanks, you know, I didn't actually know anything about this until you posted it. And so to me, I guess that was also an example of trying to think of the term. Wait for it. It's like added value in that case, maybe, right?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's nice about that point, and I agree with you, the placement of the YouTube video in the context of the discussion adds a lot of value. And you know our little Schoolhouse Rock video about understanding transformativeness, the lyric goes, context and situation determine how fair use applies. So in that context, the YouTube video adds a lot of depth to the point that your author was making. So the second question we ask when we do a transformative analysis is, did he have to use the whole photograph? Was that an appropriate amount of the work to use, considering his purpose and his use? What do you think about that?
The YouTube video?
Mount? No, of the USA Today, the picture of the whatever that vehicle was.
The MRAP.
Yeah. Because he used essentially 100% of that photograph, right?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that an appropriate amount to use considering his purpose and the nature of that photograph?
Well, then the question becomes for me when we try to communicate. And sometimes I'm describing this MRAP, which I don't think people, like I could do a detailed kind of description of it with words, but a picture of the thing in an explosion strikes me as, it's the whole picture, but it's helping me describe this thing more efficiently.
Yeah. So it's pretty essential in a short piece like this to understand what kind of military technology are we talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He's not using this just decoratively, right?
No, it's illustrating, I think, what he's talking
and
about.
And he's not using this just to attract attention in a kind of sensational way, is he?
No, I don't think so, because his whole point is that these things can withstand, you know, very large blasts.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes students use copyrighted material in their own work because they are exploiting the appeal or the familiarity of
mm-hmm.
the original text. Now, when they do that, we want to ask those hard questions about transformativeness, because when students exploit the popularity or the familiarity or the appeal of a piece of mass media culture, then they may or may not be transforming. They may be rebroadcasting, retransmitting. So those are the kind of really authentic questions that are really useful to get students to reflect more deeply on their choices. And after all, that's what you guys do as good writing teachers, right? You encourage kids to make choices and then to reflect on those choices and consider how those choices are understood by readers.
Yeah, and there was a question about where are these questions, these process questions that you are talking about. So I'm going to put that in the chat room, the link to the
Code of Best Practices.
Yes, the link to the Code of Best Practices I'm going to drop in there right now.
I just want to mention that I right-clicked on the image of the exploding machine.
Yes, I know. That particular image is actually a military image. The USA Today image is at the bottom.
All right. So even that one's on a Blogspot. It's not even from USA Today. It's so maybe somebody else used it? And then
right,
and
yeah.
He got it from third-hand source to begin with.
Right. Right. But it was identified as a USA Today photo, which brings up another question.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. I mean, the whole copyright thing, that it's so I love what Wikipedia put there. Is it Wikipedia or Wikimedia? Yeah, it is Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they said this image is the work of a sailor or employee of the U.S. Navy, taken or made during the course of the person's official duties. As a work of the U.S. federal government, the image is in the public domain.
Right.
Okay.
That's true.
So there are two ways to that, at least help me understand what we want students to do a little bit, because this is where I think there's still some fuzziness. Do we want him, when he's using this image, to go through the fair use thinking process, which I see a lot of value in, or do we want him to think about this is a public domain image and it's okay how I use it, no matter how I use it?
Well, yeah, in that case,
can he do both? Or
yeah, both of those are good. I think when you really deeply understand copyright, you understand the concept of public domain and attribution. There's a whole cluster of related concepts that all fit together.
So it would make sense then for a teacher to say, you know, for this semester, we really can't deal with fair use because it's really complicated and I'm not there yet and I got 20 other things to do. We're just going to use public domain images, or we're just going to use Creative Commons images. And then next semester, we're going to get to fair use because it's something that I really want them to deal with, but I need more time to deal with it. I mean, I'm just, well, you know, throwing it out.
Actually, yeah. Paul,
I'm not sure
where that's where I am, was because we have limited access to computers. The first semester, I didn't say anything about images. So any images that they used kind of were their own device. But this semester, I'd make more of an effort to actually teach First Amendment in general, but then copyright and fair use within that. So I'm right there.
You know what? I think we should finish.
Yeah.
I would just say, too, I don't think it's something that you can push aside, you know? It's just like discussions of teaching grammar. It's like, well, you can't just have a unit on grammar in April and hope that kids are going to get it. You know, you can't have a week on fair use in May or whatever and hope the kids mm-hmm. are going to get it. I mean, this is what I see being so valuable about the work that you keep talking about over and over on this show and helping us understand why and how to get kids to understand, you know, the academic norms of the community and citation. And now what I think the work that Renee is doing and others related to this fair use document is helping us understand the legal ramifications of it too. And I think these are very profound changes for English teachers, and we're all still wrapping our heads around it. I mean, even the chat tonight has shown that. And I've seen Renee present twice, and I've learned more tonight just by listening to her about the thing about, you know, things that are locked behind licensing agreements and so forth. And it's not something we're ever going to totally understand, but I do think it's something we need to make other teachers aware of, and certainly our students too, because there are things out there on the internet, and I, you know, I'm sorry I made fun of your question earlier, Paul, about, you know, using anything on the internet. That's not necessarily true, but if you use it and transform it and can make that critical reasoning process, what I hear Renee saying is that there's a pretty good likelihood that you can use it, and it's not only legal, it's actually contributing to our society and the mm-hmm. creative ideas that drive us forward. So I think it's really important to keep talking about.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, and Renee, I did put in the chat room that your book is coming out sometime in April, you think?
Yeah, Corwin Press.
And it is called Copyright Clarity.
That's right.
And the subtitle is a good subtitle, too. It's, what is it, How Fair Use Supports Digital Learning. So everybody should look for that when it comes out. Pardon.
Thanks so much for having me on your show tonight, you guys.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, thank
and
you,
we'll look,
guys.
We'll look for you at EduCon.
See you then.
Susan, any kind of final wrap-ups there?
Well, Langlab Cindy in the chat room really concludes for all of us by saying we try to have the teachers understand that copyright is not a check-off item. It is a process.
Nice.
Cool. Okay, so the process will continue. We do want to mention, and Chris Sloan, thank you so much for putting this show together for us tonight. Appreciate
You're
it.
Welcome. I think it really helped me further my thinking.
Good, and it let me be the bad boy in the back of the class and, you know, say whatever I want. So that was anyway, so thank you. And we do also want to thank Dave Cormier and Jeff Lebo at worldbridges.net and edtechtalk.com, where this will be eventually put up as a podcast. And the chat that was going on in the background will be there as well. And it's also at teachersteachingteachers.org. Thank you all, and good evening.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Night.